Professor Alison van Eenennaam works in cooperative extension, translating agricultural research into education and practical action. Alison grew up in Melbourne, Australia, but was working in California when the Flavour Saver tomato became the first commercially grown GMO food to be approved for human consumption. She quickly found herself immersed in the world of biotechnology and agricultural science. In this conversation, Alison and Kirsty talk about GMO foods, bringing the science of universities into farming operations, the value of science outreach to communicate facts, not fear, and the future of genomics in cattle production.
Hi, Alison. Welcome to our podcast. It's a real pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for the invitation.
My pleasure. So tell me a little bit in a sort of a nice elevator pitch that we're all asked to do these days, what exactly your job entails and what your research is about.
I'm a professor of cooperative extension in the field of animal genomics and biotechnology. And what cooperative extension does is it takes science from the university to farmers. And so my area of kind of research is where can we use genetics and genomics in livestock breeding programs with a particular emphasis on cows to basically accelerate the rate of genetic gain, and then taking that idea to farmers and talking to them about their breeding programs and what they can do to improve their cattle production.
What's the big picture goal of the work that you do?
The work of cooperative extension is to try to accelerate the adoption of innovation in agriculture. And I think if we look back historically at the importance of that, it's been a key driver of the modernization, if you will, of agricultural production in the United States. I think a very, very positive, hefty return on investment there, in that if you can get that research out of the ivory tower, if you will, and then truth test it with producers, come back and say, this didn't work because this wasn't well suited to production, and then have that interface. And I feel a little bit like I'm just an interface between the problems of industry and what we can achieve in academia, and how we can marry that together for translational outcomes and see ideally adoption in industry for things. I mean, like, let's think about the SNP chip, for example. You know, that's been widely adopted in all of the animal livestock breeding industries to improve the accuracy of selection. That's a classic example of a kind of a nerdy scientific discovery that's now widely utilized to improve and accelerate the rate of genetic gain in our livestock production system.
Now, as scientists, I think we often struggle to define ourselves in our area of research. So what would you define yourself as? A biotechnologist, an agricultural scientist, a geneticist?
I think at heart an agricultural scientist, because that was really what I trained in, and biotechnology didn't really exist when I was training, so that came later. But then, of course, with a speciality in genetics, and then more specifically utilizing biotechnology. So I guess it's a little pyramid to some extent, but at my core, it's all about food production.
Now, many people, I think, in agricultural science come from a rural background because they've seen the importance of agriculture on society. Is that true for you?
Actually, it's not. Kirsty, I was raised in the suburbs of Melbourne, had relatives with farms and used to spend my summers at my auntie's farm, but was not personally involved, and really got interested in it as a result of when I was growing up. I was born in the 60s and there was a lot of famines, and it was always in the media, and that got me interested. I went to actually a career night, and there was someone who was promoting agricultural science, and it was right around the time of Norman Borlaug, and I was just interested in trying to address this, one of our major problems at the time, which was chronic famines. And so that's what got me interested, in addition a little bit to working on farms and, you know, having a horse and the usual things. So yeah, that was my genesis. My parents were very encouraging to do what I wanted to do, but I don't think they thought that this would be a career path I would necessarily select.
And so what was your field like when you were training? Was there sufficient expertise in the field in Australia?
Well, I started off doing agricultural science, and so I think absolutely in my bachelor's there was. In fact, I had a pretty good geneticist training me at Mike Goddard. You might have heard of him. So I think I got a great degree there. But in terms of biotechnology, where we're talking more about recombinant DNA technology and the like, that field really didn't develop until I was, well, probably into my postgraduate career. And at the time, that was happening more in the United States. I didn't leave Australia because there wasn't a lot of biotechnology going on. It didn't work that way. It was kind of the other way around. But as it happened, I was in Davis, California, when the Flavor Saver tomato, the first genetically engineered crop, was released. And I was working there at that time. And so I kind of just immersed in it by happenstance, because I came to Davis to do an exchange year because it's the agricultural campus of the University of California system, not because of biotechnology. And I really backed into that accidentally, to be honest. It just kind of aligned with what I was doing in my career at that time.
So you went to the US then as an exchange program, and then you went back there for your postgraduate studies?
That's correct. Yeah, I did the senior year, or the fourth year, of my ag science degree at the University of California. There's an education abroad program, which was really great in the years I went through university. And I'm sorry, younger people, but at the time it was free. We didn't have HECS. And so I was able to enroll in Melbourne Uni and come to the UC Davis tuition for free for a year. And I met a professor there. It was his first year teaching, Dr. Juan Medrano, who ended up becoming the person that I did my postgraduate master's and PhD with. And so he encouraged me in that year, or when I was learning genetics from him, to do research projects as an undergraduate. And then he kind of, to be honest, talked me into doing postgraduate research, because I'm always wanting to get out and get a job. And I kind of kept coming back like a bad penny to the university to do degree after degree. Yeah, it was really just a very fortunate happenstance of who happened to be teaching me the year that I was on my exchange program.
And how do you find the research culture in Australia versus America?
I have a hard time answering that, because I really wasn't involved in the research culture in Australia. I left pretty much when I was around 20 and haven't really ever worked down there in the research culture. I guess, you know, a couple of flippant things I can say, having just done a sabbatical at UQ there last year, is that there's a lot more social interaction, I think, during the day at Australian universities, like the morning tea concept, or lunch, getting together at lunchtime and talking about whatever, doesn't really exist here. So everyone hangs in their office and just works all day. There's really not a lot of interaction. And I really like that, because you can kind of bounce ideas off each other and get a bit of a, you know, your head in a bit of a different space to just sitting at your computer all day. So I think that's a little bit different. And I think there's a real, almost say, overwork ethic here, in terms of it's really expected or rewarded that you will work more than 8 hours a day, especially at university campuses. And that's certainly the model I stepped into when I first started here. I think that's changing now with just a whole bunch of different social events and things, and COVID and what have you. I think there's a lot less willingness to do that kind of above and beyond work now. But during the time I've been a faculty member here for the last 20 years, I think that culture is very alive and well.
It's an interesting point, and I sort of always like to come back to this with our guests about work-life balance. So we will come back to that. I'm just wanting to pick up on something that you said earlier, that you were always keen to sort of get a quote-unquote real job outside of academia. Can you tell me a little bit about your experiences outside of academia, and what seems to keep bringing you back to the university system?
Just bad life choices. No. So, I mean, I have worked a lot. When I finished my undergraduate degree, I went and worked for Cooper's Animal Health as a developmental scientist in Camden, in near Sydney. There I had just a bachelor's and just come out of Davis, obviously. Did work as a research scientist there, but had no control over my own program. And I was like, this is not quite right. And Dr. Medrano was here at UC Davis saying, come back and do a master's, you know. And I was like, okay, all right, that's just 2 years. I can cope with that. So I went back, did the master's. And then I got a job in what's called cooperative extension, or I think it's just extension in Australia, but actually in a county-based or a shire-based position would be the analogous term in Australia, working with dairy producers and livestock farmers in two counties here in the San Joaquin Valley, which is like a huge agricultural region of California, basically bringing the science of the university to farmers. And the county-based agents work in tandem with the university campus-based specialist to bring the research and education of the university to farmers. And that's been a model that's been in place at the US land-grant universities since, I think, Abraham Lincoln, if I'm not mistaken. And so I was there for 3 years, and then I was still didn't have control over my own research program. And so I was like, oh, do I go back and do a PhD, which is a 5-year commitment here? There's, you know, 2 years of coursework and at least 3 years of research. And I had a paying job, but I spoke it over with my husband. It's like, okay, let's do this. I'm not going to be happy doing what I'm doing. So I came back to the university and did my 5 years. And at the end of that, I was wanting to get a real job. That stage, I was at Davis. My husband also works at the university, and there really wasn't any jobs related to animal science in the area. And so that's when I took the job working for Calgene as a molecular geneticist, because that's what I trained in. And at the end of the day, DNA is DNA. Who cares if it's a cow or a plant? And it was a private company. And as it happened, during the period I was there for 3.5 years, was when I had my two kids. That was a brilliant stroke of genius. Absolutely happenstance and random, but if you're going to have kids, working at a private company is a really good time to do it, because they have much better 6 weeks leave policies, which is what they have here. And I guess I wouldn't say, to be honest, just quietly, that Calgene got the best of my brain, because I was kind of in that exhausted mummy phase during most of my time there. And then this job that I have now opened up in 2002 when my youngest son was just 2. I took this job and I was actually 39 when I started my faculty position, because here I have the ability to do what I want to do, and I do have creative control over what I research. And that was what was missing in private enterprise to me a little bit. And also, I'm sorry, Arabidopsis, you're just not that exciting. I'd much rather work with animals. It was a very logical job for me to take, and as it happens, one that I haven't gone back to get another degree, so I guess I might be stuck in this job for my career at this stage.
I mean, as somebody who flunked out of botany, I completely hear you.
Sorry, I don't want to identify sepals and petioles.
I'm just wondering if we can come back to what you mentioned about having kids, because I think that's a really challenging time for women in science who decide they want to have a family, or women who are trying to advance their career with especially young children. Could you offer any advice to women who are in academia and don't necessarily have the luxury of, you know, a non-academic job? What's the best way to manage that time in your life and manage your career?
I'm probably a bit old to ask, just because I'm following along behind the generation that was ahead of me that basically had to forego having a family if you wanted to be an academic. There's people in my department that had to make that choice. And there was a couple of women ahead of me that were trying to have kids and a career too. But it was very much like, well, we'll let you come. Don't be mentioned any of that stuff. Just keep working. Don't let it affect your career path. Well, I didn't actually have my babies right here, but I didn't do anything differently because I had young children in terms of expectations. That was hard, but it was also kind of what was expected at the time. You didn't take long amounts of time off, and there wasn't really a culture of accepting that there's going to be a time in your life when the kids are little that you're not going to be as productive as when they're not there, you know, needing attention every single day. And I think that culture is changing, but I think academia and particularly, I think, STEM sciences, it's really hard because the field is not taking its time to relax whilst you're home, just relaxing with a baby, so to speak. That research is going along. And so if you get too far out of it, you're going to kind of lose your edge a little bit. And I see that a lot. And there was a very interesting conversation I had with a senior academic who said to me something like, where did you come from? You came out of nowhere, kind of. And it's true. When my kids were little, I was at university working, but I didn't travel very much at all. I wasn't at conferences. I intentionally minimized how much I was gone, partly because my husband works too. And so, like, there's not the freedom to travel. But once the kids were in school, and then I could kind of get out and about, and then I came out of nowhere. And it's like, well, I wasn't nowhere, but I wasn't as prominent or as much on the speaking circuit, because at that stage I made that decision that that's what I wanted to spend my time doing. And so I think that really hurts your career too, because you don't get known. You know, you see, oh, this promising young man, you'll hear that a lot. And it's like, you don't often see that so much. I think it's changing now, and I think things are getting better. But when I went through, it was actually interesting. I actually work in the department where my major professor was, and I was advised when I took the job, don't do any collaborative work with him, because it'll be looked on as if you're still just his graduate student. And your very logical colleague and mentor is like, don't do anything with them. Don't do anything like what they're doing, because you've got to establish your independence, because otherwise people will just assume you're his grad student. And I look at young faculty members now, and it's like, is anyone telling them not to keep working with their faculty that they did their PhD with? Like, that's your main support network. And it was kind of a crazy concept when I look back on it. It's like, why would you sever that link? Because the assumption would be, oh, well, you know, she's just basically still being his grad student. And it's like, kind of crazy, but that's how it was at the time. So I'm not sure I have any great advice for people. It's not easy, and your brain will not function very well for a couple of years. It's just the fact. And those years are the tough years, and it gets better. They grow up. It's not as tiring, but those first 2 years, especially breastfeeding, is just exhausting. You know, that midnight, like, and it's just be like, oh, no, go back to sleep, no. And yeah, it was. Oh.
So let's turn to your research then. If you had to pick something in your research career that you would say was your most exciting or significant finding, what would that be?
Oh, you know, I think at research, there's a lot of days when not very much exciting happens. And then there's this one occasional day that's just like, oh my gosh, that's the best research results ever. And I think those are the days when you get a pregnancy check on a genome-edited animal that you really love with your whole body, and there's a pregnancy positive. That's like the best feeling on earth. And then you've got 9 months to wait for the anticipation of what's going to come out if you're working with cows. So I think just those very rare wins that happen. I think we've had a couple of interesting cattle born over the years. So Cosmo, when he was born, you know, he was a knock-in that was done in embryos. It was a 6-year project to get him born, but he came right in the middle of COVID too. So there was a lot of drama because he was a very big calf, and all of the drugs you need to give people, intubate them to put the COVID things in to help them breathe, that's the same drugs you use for cesarean sections in cows. And so it was in limited supply. We weren't sure we were going to have enough to do a C-section. And so luckily he was born naturally, but, you know, crazy things like that were happening during COVID. But I think actually my bigger wins have been in science communication. And that's actually 75% of my job is that, not research. So 25% is research. It's almost a hobby on the side. So that the scientific outreach is a bigger part. And so obviously working with producers, but because I'm in this fairly controversial area, I've done quite a lot of work on outreach as it relates to genetic engineering and GMOs. Probably my best career thing ever was doing a televised debate, the Intelligence Square at a theatre in New York City, debating GMOs in front of this large New York City urban audience. So not necessarily people you would think would be allied with the idea of GMOs. And it was an Oxford-style debate. It's 90 minutes and you back and forth with two people for, two people against. And at the end of the day, long story short, we were able to win that debate by a sizable margin, which was so unexpected. And it was just really very gratifying. And I've never debated before ever in my life. That's my one and only debate. And I think that was a really big win because it gave the opportunity for the discussion to happen in a way that didn't become all polarized like it does often with these politicized scientific topics. It was very direct moderator who said, no, got to keep having discussions around the facts, like, you know, like to bring in other things. And it actually was effective at actually changing this urban group's mind from largely undecided to largely in favor of the use of this technology in breeding. And so I think that was probably my biggest professional win, for want of a better expression.
obviously your job then in its entirety involves a lot of scientific communication. And I think there's a lot of still somewhat negative perception about scientific communication, or people still underappreciate the value of this. Why do you think it's important for researchers, academics, to be involved in science outreach?
I'm a very outcomes-driven kind of a person. I kind of feel like if you do research and it doesn't ever get implemented in industry, why bother? And I think it's so important to have those translational outcomes. And I do think it's really important for academics to engage in science communication, especially at this juncture in history. We're seeing a tremendous threat to our democracies from misinformation and lack of critical thinking skills. And I think it's a skill that we need to amp up to ensure that our policies are being driven by our best available knowledge and not fear or emotions. And it concerns me that when we allow things like politics to interfere with what should be science-based decisions, especially in agriculture, it has very deleterious outcomes. And I use the example of the Great Leap Forward. Agriculture doesn't really mind what your political affiliation is. There are certain biological principles that make food grow, and we have to be basing our decisions on those facts. And I think there's a very scary precedence with Lysenko, and more recently in Sri Lanka, where suddenly all the inputs were pulled from agriculture, and you actually had the collapse of that agricultural system and that economy. For very brave people that want to ignore what the best scientific suggestions are for how to run our agricultural production systems. And so I'm very passionate about that. It's very easy to let emotions guide you to a decision that's actually not optimal for agricultural production.
Let's talk about GMOs, because as you say, it's a very controversial topic. So to give you some context, some of the work I do is in avian influenza, and there's been a long discussion in avian influenza about genetically modifying chickens to make them resistant to avian flu. But it's very, very interesting to see, in particular in areas around Europe, I would say that the interest in that is not very high because of the genetic modification and implications. So could you talk a little bit about what GMOs offer in the context of cattle breeding and what opportunities they offer, and what the common concerns are that you have to address with your scientific communication?
Well, I'm going to start by defining a GMO, because there's, you know, old-fashioned GMOs, if you will, genetic engineering, where you're introducing traits into an animal that you might want, for example, resistance to avian flu, but you're using techniques, kind of older style techniques, where it integrates randomly in the genome and you're typically expressing some sort of a DNA construct that's not native to that bird, so a transgene, so to speak. That's old-fashioned GMOs, and that, of course, has been used very widely in crop breeding, and there's literally millions of farmers growing that around the world, and was very limited in its use in animal agriculture, in part because of the pushback that came as it relates to GMOs in plants, which was largely fermented by concerns regarding large multinational companies, Monsanto being one of them, the big evil M. And it got kind of all embroiled in weed treatments and Roundup and glyphosate and large multinational companies, that none of which have anything to do with animals, right? And so even though it could have been used for useful things like disease-resistant animals, we were having this discussion in plants. And that was why I was interested in getting involved, because we couldn't use the technology at all because of this discussion that was around plants. And the discussion was not rational. It was often driven by safety concerns being brought up by opponents that were not supported at all by the data in any country in the world. And I think that was the first time I kind of realized, oh my goodness, like, this is fake news, or, you know, this alternative narrative that has taken the public and they believe it now. And, you know, I think that this misinformation that we're dealing with now as it relates to vaccines and things, I feel agricultural scientists have been dealing with that for a long time. I feel like, you know, when a doctor's complaining, I'm kind of like, hold my beer, because I think we've been dealing with that a lot. And people can have legitimate concerns around large multinational corporations, but still be supportive of golden rice and, you know, papayas in Hawaii and the Calgene tomato. You know, that was a little startup company at the time it came through. And so, unfortunately, all of those topics got conflated. And now we have the opportunity to utilize some of the newer molecular techniques like genome editing, and where we're not necessarily introducing a transgenic construct, and we might go in and just switch off a gene that makes cattle heat tolerant, like the prolactin receptor. We might go in and tweak a gene so that all of our northern cattle no longer grow horns because they've got the POLD mutation, which is an animal welfare issue. It's a cattle loss issue. It kind of aligns with recommendations from like the RSPCA to utilize polled animals in your breeding programs. And so I feel like it's a little bit of a different discussion now, in part because the big evil GMO is gone, and so is Monsanto. I mean, there isn't any Monsanto really in animal breeding. And for cattle, I think the potential is things like disease resistance. There's an animal that's been produced at the Meat Animal Research Center here that's resistant to BVD, bovine viral diarrhea. I was just at a conference this week with groups from the Roslin Institute working on genome-edited chickens for avian influenza resistance. The story of avian influenza is such a big zoonotic concern. And here is a technology coming along to try to address some of these animal diseases and welfare things, or producing single-sex chickens. I know Mark Tizard down at CSIRO in Melbourne is trying to produce all girls for the layer industry. Those types of things seem to me to align with just reasonable people's viewpoint of how this technology should be used. You're always going to have the really anti-activists and the really pro-people, but the people that we convinced in New York City, the undecideds, I really think that some of those applications do align with the values of our consumers, or our customers, if you will, and that those are the applications that I would really like to see go forward. And in fact, the first thing going forward is a disease-resistant pig. The PRRS, porcine reproductive respiratory syndrome virus pig, is being taken to market by a large multinational company called Genus, which has Pig Improvement Corporation. But that's a big undertaking to introduce that. It needs to be in the recessive condition in all of their parent lines that contribute to the four-way cross that makes a commercial pig. You need a company to do that. It's not going to be something that's going to be just one or two animals. You really need to do the entire kind of nucleus at the top of the breeding pyramid in order for the homozygous recessive to come all the way down and give those animals protection from the virus. And so it's not just a matter of getting it done once. You have to do it in a breeding program. And that actually is, I think, the difficult part of some of these technologies.
And will those pigs be ultimately approved for human consumption?
So yes, they will. So the company has announced publicly that they are taking it through regulatory approval in several different countries. It's already got approval in one country, so that's Colombia. Most of Latin America, if you're not introducing novel DNA, you're just inactivating a gene like they are in this case, they're not treating them any differently to conventional breeding. So they don't have to go through a new regulatory process. So they've already got it there, and Brazil and Argentina won't be far behind. Those countries, because of their regulatory approach, will be like that. So Australia, a knockout, that is, you're not introducing novel DNA, it's called an SDN1, they've also announced that they won't treat that any differently to conventional breeding. So those pigs potentially could come in. They'd still need to go through food safety approval at Fasans, but from a gene technology regulator perspective, they're not treated differently to conventional breeding. And other countries are similarly, they're being approached. And I think China also is one of the countries they're going to get approval in, which is a huge pork consumer. So I think that in that case, I think, yes, that is their plan, is to get approval. Now, the EU is not on the list. And you know what? Fine. It just let them eat their own pigs. You know, I think, and it's ironic because the company is actually a UK-based company, but the path to market is still unclear for genome-edited products in the EU. And so I think the company's quite sensibly going, well, you know, where the pigs are at is China, and where it's produced is these countries. We'll get approvals there, and then we'll go on from there. And that's basically what they're doing.
Fantastic. Well, I could keep talking about this all day, particularly because it's vested research interest of mine. But I think we should just wrap it up. And I would just like to get your insights as to what advice you would give to younger women entering a career in science or trying to establish themselves within their field of science.
Yeah, it's a difficult question because there's so much to juggle when you're a young person. But I think what I wish I had a little bit more guidance on was finding a mentor that would help me, or I don't want to use the term life coach, but someone more experienced, I guess is a nice way to put it, female faculty now that you can look towards and get advice as to how to handle the system, I think is it would be something that would have been very helpful. I know I'm now on mentoring committees for several of the newer faculty in our department, and I always find it a little bit funny because it's like, I'm not sure what to do in this meeting because I've never had a mentoring meeting. But I mean, intuitively, you know what things worked for you and where to focus your time and attention. And I think what I noticed in Australia is there seems to be difficulty going from, I forget there's level A, B, C, D, E. It's going from that postdoc to kind of the assistant or associate professor position seems to be a bottleneck or a difficult hurdle. And so I think there are, I know at UQ there was some programs to help you with that. We call them a barrier step in our promotion package to make sure that you're on the right track and getting the right kind of balance of publications and research and teaching and whatever your job description is in order for you to be successful at that barrier step, if that's what you choose to do. And, you know, there's plenty of good jobs that are not being a professor. And I totally recognize that. I've had my toe in both camps my whole life. And some days I still look out the door and think, well, gosh, private industry sure looks good right now. So that is a totally legitimate career choice. And you have to do something that you get excited to get up in the morning for. And if you're dreading your day for whatever reason, have a step back and go, okay, is it the work? Is it the environment? What is it that I'm not comfortable with? And what can I do to change that and kind of plot a path towards that outcome?
Fantastic. Thank you so much for your time and your insights, Alison. And we look forward to seeing the next updates about GMOs in agriculture.
There you go. All right. Thank you so much, Kirsty.
You've been listening to Women in Science. Your donation can help us tell more stories like this one. You can find the donation link in the episode notes. Production for this episode was by Dr. Marina Fortes, Dr. Marlous Decker, and Dr. Kirsty Short. Senior technical production was by Dan Seed. Make sure you subscribe to Women in Science. Thanks for listening.